What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back or welcome to the High Flyers podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase the brightest and most relatable role models and companies and their journey from sunrise to today. As one of the premier products in our Curiosity Center lineup, providing on-demand intelligence, featuring Olympic athletes, business and cultural leaders, students, journalists, investors, founders, and more from around the world to help you be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's have some fun. Today, in this episode 131, I'm speaking with Michael Kim, founder and managing partner of Sendana Capital. Learn about Michael's sunrise in Morgantown, West Virginia, in the US, a town of just 27,000 people. Learn about his cultural influences with his mum born and raised in Japan and dad from Korea. I love the fact that his mum still speaks to him in Japanese and he replies in English. Michael shares how he explored a career in politics and then, as he calls it, had a sea change and went into banking, which then led to a role in a technology M&A team in San Francisco and eventually venture capital. We deep dive into his journey founding Sendana Capital, an investment firm referred to as a fund of funds, meaning they're a fund that invests in other VC funds. We cover how they started, building track record and economics, their diligence process of new VCs they back, investing globally, with Australia and Israel being some examples, thought process changes, especially on ownership levels, relative to fund size, seed versus pre-seed funds, Hall of Fame LPs, and more. And our 7-star events are back. Yes, as many of you know, tickets are quickly selling out for the special series of live fireside conversations I'm hosting in May and June. Buy your ticket today via the link in the show notes. It's now over to Michael, who's highly regarded in the venture capital community globally, so this one's special. It's time to explore your curiosity. Please enjoy. Michael Kim, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Thank you for joining me. A number of your fund managers have been on the podcast, including Shil Manott, Sam Wong, Nikki Shavak, and they all speak very highly of you. So I'm glad we could finally do this. Why don't we start with some fun facts to set the scene? Where were you born and where do you live now?
I was born in Morgantown, West Virginia. That's a university town, basically 40 minutes south of Pittsburgh. So it's an area called Mid-Atlantic, and it's closer to the eastern seaboard than the West Coast, which is where I'm located today. I moved to San Francisco in 1997, so almost 26 years, and I'm in my home office here in San Francisco.
And from a work perspective, what was your first job, and what do you do now?
First job? Well, when I was a little boy, maybe 14, my mother wanted me to actually start earning some money. So I ended up working as a stock boy in a department store in my town. And I did that for one summer. And then we can talk a lot more about this, but my mother's family was based in Japan. And my grandfather owned a factory. And so when I was 16, 17, for two summers, I went there and I actually worked in the factory. And this was a factory where basically they were making office furniture. And so my job every day was to basically bolt doors onto the bodies of like lockers. And that day actually started at six in the morning and it ended at six at night. So it was pretty long days. It was also not air conditioned. So it was not the most pleasant working conditions. But, you know, I think my mother really wanted me to see what it was like working with your hands. And, you know, what kind of life that leads to. And, you know, with the lesson being, if you can use your brain and your mind, that might be a better path.
Incredible. And how would you describe your role now at Sendana Capital?
So I'm the founder of Sendana Capital. Started it about 12 years ago. It's an investment management firm. And it's basically, our primary business is a fund of funds. So we raise capital from investors. And then we invest that capital into various funds like Shields at Better Tomorrow or Nikki's fund in Blackbird or Sam Wong's fund, which is Blackbird in New Zealand. So we make these investments into funds, work with the fund managers, and, you know, unlike say a university endowment or maybe a superannuation fund in Australia, where you kind of have a permanent source of capital, we raise these funds ourselves every 2 to 3 years. So we do a combination of investing and raising capital on our own, and of course, managing our portfolios.
I would love to get into that in a few minutes. And Michael, as you know, the purpose of this show is to reimagine a high flyer. I wonder, is there a high flyer you know who you feel hasn't got the recognition they deserve?
That's a really good question. You know, I guess I would say that my partner, Kelly Fontaine, who is a younger person, but a superstar in our world, is starting to get recognition. And, you know, I really want to mentor members of our team. And I've been trying to get her more appearances at conferences, on panels and things like that. So I'd highly recommend you talking to her.
Sam Wong actually mentioned her name. I think they work quite closely together. So maybe a future guest for sure. I would love to wind back the clock, Michael, and go to your sunrise, your childhood. You touched on it earlier with some of your answers. Let's start with family. What was the influence of family, particularly the cultural influences? I understand your dad is Korean and your mom's Japanese. Is that right?
Yeah, well, she was born and raised in Japan, but she's from a Korean family. And so her father, my maternal grandfather, moved to Japan in the late teens, 1900. So like 1913, 1917, something like that. And, you know, built his business, did very, very well. And my mom was, you know, raised in Japan, was educated in Japan, went to college in Japan. And my father grew up in a part of Korea called Daegu. And he came from a political family. His father, my paternal grandfather, was a member of the National Assembly, which is like the U.S. Congress. And so a lot of his relatives were involved with the government. And, you know, my father went to Seoul National University, sort of like the top school in Korea, was president of the student body. So it was very well liked. And people thought that he had a great political future. And back in those days, a lot of families arrange their sons and daughters to get married. And so my maternal grandfather has six daughters, and each one of them, he was almost picking a specific industry to marry them off into. And my mom, who's still alive, is super smart. But as a woman, she couldn't go into business. And so the thinking there was that she would be arranged to be married into a political family. So my parents actually had met each other five times before they were actually married. So it was a truly like an arranged marriage.
Yeah, wow. It sounds very similar to my parents. I'm Indian heritage, and my parents were arranged marriage as well. So yeah, very interesting how things were.
Yeah, but the way it worked out though is completely different. Right. So as Mike Tyson says, you have a plan until you get punched in the face. My father decided to go get a master's and a PhD in the U.S. And so he went to Georgetown because naturally Georgetown is in Washington, D.C., and he wanted to be involved in politics. And ultimately, he decided he did not actually want to go back to Korea. And he instead wanted to go into academia. So he became a professor, which is actually how we ended up in Morgantown, West Virginia. The university there is called the West Virginia University. And he was a professor of international relations. And so my mother, who grew up pretty wealthy in Japan, was suddenly now married and living in Morgantown's a town of 27,000 people. It's relatively cosmopolitan because of the university. And so, you know, you had professors and their families from all over the world. But it's not exactly what she was probably envisioning. And, you know, we had a really great childhood. We had a nice little house. I have two younger brothers. And, you know, back in the day, you could go outside and play. My mom would send us out at 9 a.m. We'd hop on our bikes and go visit our friends. And we'd come home by 6. You know, of course, that's on the weekends, not during the school day.
I'm fascinated about the cultural influence, Michael, particularly the mix of Asian and Western cultures, having grown up in the US, but then a strong Korean Japanese heritage. Did that influence you growing up? Like, did your parents want you to keep the tradition of Japanese and Korean heritage going?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, my at least interesting to me, my mother still speaks to me in Japanese, and I speak to her in English. And you know, as part of growing up, we would actually go back to Japan and Korea every summer. So, you know, not many kids in the U.S. would travel internationally, I'd say, certainly not every summer. And, you know, that's something that was a part, you know, is a part of me. I traveled internationally since I was a little boy, and we would basically spend 2 months in Japan and then 1 month in Korea. So, you know, it was very sort of cross-cultural. Japan and Korea are very different countries. And, you know, I think being able to have the American perspective, a Japanese perspective, and Korean perspective, you know, is pretty unique. And I think, you know, ultimately, I've come to appreciate, you know, the different cultural influences on me.
Incredible. I was in Japan in 2015, and it was probably my most amazing holiday to go on. I think the people and the culture and the organization of the country is next to none.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Michael, if you fast forward to when you were 18, and hopefully by this time you've got some understanding of the world and yourself, what was success at that age? What did you want to do in life?
Yeah, so also just to touch back on your question about cultural influences, you know, obviously my parents were very focused on academic performance. You know, obviously my father was a professor at a university, and you know, so we worked really hard in school. And you know, I remember coming home as, you know, let's say a 10, 12 year old boy, and my mom had written out math problems on a piece of paper that I had to do in addition to my regular homework. So there was definitely that ethos of working hard and doing as well as you can. So I guess when I was 18, I actually didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but my parents stereotypically wanted me to become a doctor. And so, you know, I had gone to Cornell University, and this was back in the late 80s. And, you know, my first year I took the requisite courses for pre-medical studies, and that included organic chemistry and biology and things like that. And I didn't do well. Science was really never my strong suit. And so, you know, I ultimately had to make that tough call to my parents saying, I'm not going to become a medical doctor. And in fact, I may want to go into law. And I just picked law because it seemed easier. Obviously, it's not. But it just felt like, you know, reading, at least the study in preparation for going to law school, was more appealing to me, which are subjects like in history and economics and international relations, which is ultimately what I focused my academics on.
This episode is brought to you by Full Stack Advisory. Tired of accountants who just don't understand your tech business? Full Stack Advisory is Australia's top tech accounting firm designed specifically for innovative tech founders and investors. They provide founder-friendly support across accounting and tax, R&D tax incentives, bookkeeping, and CFO advisory, so you can focus on what you do best, innovating and growing your business. Head across to fullstack.com.au and tell them Vidit from the High Flyers podcast sent you to have your accounting needs sorted by Stuart and the team. That's fullstack.com.au. And I do understand you went to Cornell and studied international relations. So was that your dad's influence again, the diplomatic experience where you were like, okay, maybe I'll try that?
Yeah, for sure. You know, plus as a child, as I mentioned, I traveled a lot back to Asia, and it was always interesting to see how, you know, part of it is that like when we were in Korea, as I mentioned, it was a militarized country back then. You know, there weren't that much freedom of speech, and, you know, it wasn't a true democracy. And so, you know, even as a kid, you could see that difference, you know, obviously manifested in the fact that there's soldiers around, you know, armed with machine guns. But anyway, so, you know, and I also spent a lot of time studying history, you know, Bismarck, Metternich, you know, the European ones, classical Greek and Roman. And, you know, a lot of those stories, I think, were very fascinating to me, where, you know, it was basically people who were creating opportunities or faced with threats and how they reacted. And I thought that was really interesting. So by the time I became in my final year at Cornell, I decided I wanted to actually become a diplomat. So so I applied to the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown for a master's degree. And fortunately, I was admitted to that. So that's what I did immediately after Cornell. I went to to Georgetown and, you know, decided that, you know, it was wonderful being in Washington, D.C. Classmates of mine, their parents were ambassadors. So we would hang out at the embassy, go to these different events. But, you know, we were studying under some really interesting people, including Madeleine Albright, who was U.S. Secretary of State. And, you know, and if you remember, that was also the time right after the Berlin Wall fell. And so there were a lot of interesting changes going on. That was around the time of Boris Yeltsin and how Russia became, the Soviet Union ultimately became a democracy and, or, you know, effectively a democracy. my first, after my first year, I had this epiphany. I'm like, I'm not going to spend 20 years climbing up the government ladder. In fact, if I go to the government, I'd rather be appointed. So I had that hubris thinking, okay, I'm going to be a successful person in the business world. And then ultimately that may translate to working for the government, you know, once I've retired or once I'm older. So that was sort of the sea change back at that time. So I decided to go into banking. So I ended up working at Chase Manhattan Bank, which now is part of JP Morgan. I was on the corporate side and we were basically doing credit analysis. So that was a really interesting time because the way that credit program was structured, it was 6 months of in-class training with MBA professors from NYU and Columbia. That was really good training. And I did that for basically 3 years from 92 to 95. And I worked actually abroad. So I worked in London, worked in Buenos Aires in Argentina, worked in Hong Kong, worked in Frankfurt, and really got an opportunity to travel around. So that was, I thought, a really fun time. And also, I learned a lot.
Would you say that accelerated your career? Because I imagine a lot of your peers probably would have been in a U.S. city and they would just be working in there. Was you're getting this international exposure very early in your career?
You know, what I would say is that it made me decide that back then in the U.S., commercial banking and investment banking were kept separate through a government act called Glass-Steagall. And so, you know, I would see my friends working at Morgan Stanley, at Goldman Sachs in investment banking and mergers acquisitions, and it was much faster pace and they seemed to be working on more substantial things. So I actually concluded that I wanted to go into investment banking. And to do that, I decided I needed an inflection point, and that inflection point was going to business school. So I applied to Wharton, got in, and went to Wharton. And, you know, luckily I was able to get a summer associate job at Morgan Stanley in the M&A department. So I had my dream summer job, did well enough that they gave me a full-time offer. And, so the second year of business school actually was relatively carefree, I'd say, because I already had a full-time offer. And, but the reason why I mentioned that is because I started at, Morgan Stanley M&A department, 1997 in August, and I was just really excited. And I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do this for the next 20 years, become a managing director, and then I'm going to go work at KKR or Blackstone or Carlyle. Right. So I actually was originally thinking I was going to go into private equity. And, you know, sure enough, things changed. And 1 month later, there was an opening in San Francisco for the technology M&A team. And so if you remember 1997 to 2000, that was the first internet bubble. The Morgan Stanley M&A team, along with Goldman Sachs M&A team, were very, very active in a lot of the transactions that happened around the first internet bubble. Our colleagues in corporate finance, they were doing a lot of the IPOs. So like my friends over on the corporate finance side worked on the Amazon IPO and things like that. So it's a very, very interesting time. And I mentioned this because that's actually when I first started working with and seeing private companies that had been funded by venture capitalists.
very, very interesting. And I'm sure you've taken a lot of learnings from that you're applying to now, where now compared to 2000 feels like a very happy, rosy period, right? Economically.
Yeah. The other major lesson is that I tell my children and basically anyone who'll listen to me is that you need to be nice to all the junior people. And the reason I say that is, for example, you know, I was a second year associate, so I was kind of near the bottom of the totem pole. And, you know, we would have investment banking analysts working with us. And, you know, these analysts work 12-hour days, if not more. And a lot of them actually turn out to have substantial positions in the world, you know, later on in their lives. So, for example, Egon Durban was an analyst at Morgan Stanley in the office that I was, and now he's running Silver Lake. You know, Brett Rockhine was an analyst I worked with a lot, and he ended up being the co-head of technology for General Atlantic. You know, he helped make the investment in their investment in Alibaba. Another one I worked a lot with is Mike Lee, and Mike now runs venture for Stanford's endowment. And so, you know, oftentimes investment banking gets negative, you know, and there are a lot of negatives about investment banking, the hard hours, but also, you know, some of the more senior people can be total assholes. And, you know, I think the lesson here that I've always carried on was, you know, always be nice to the junior people. And because you actually never know where they're going to end up, and you might end up having to work for them. So, you know, I think that was something that has always stuck with me.
What's that line? The people you see on the way up is the people you see on the way down. And I think it's very true where things can change quickly. Yep. I want to go into, I noticed in my research that after Morgan, you spent almost 10 years at a place called Rustic Canyon Partners in San Francisco. And I went, that's a very long time period, firstly. So clearly you must have grown there and you must have been motivated to stay on. But can you talk about some of your highlights from that period? Maybe first, what was your role there? Because you said general partner, and I don't know exactly what that meant at that firm.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the role and what were some of your highlights from that time there?
Yeah, let me describe this. So, you know, I was a second year associate. One of the people I worked with is Mark Minnell, and he was a vice president and then a principal later on. But he had been working with a company called Times Mirror. And Times Mirror was the owner of the LA Times and some other sort of media properties. And the family that basically started Times Mirror, you know, they wanted to create an alternative investment program. So they tapped the CFO of Times Mirror, Tom Unterman. And then so Tom brought Mark on board to help run this alternative investment program. It was a $500 million slug of capital. And Mark and I worked closely together. So he pulled me in and Tom brought in some people from Times Mirror. So I think at the beginning, there were six or seven of us sitting with $500 million of dry powder. And ostensibly the idea was to do venture capital investing, growth equity investing. We also did a small buyout. So it wasn't a pure play venture capital firm, but you know we were looking at investment opportunities. So that was a great start, and you know coming as a second year associate, as becoming a full partner in a fund was I guess transformative. The only issue was that you know in March of 2000 everything crashed, right? So the next few years, especially in venture, weren't happy years. And, you know, it was actually a very tough time to be running a venture capital fund. So, you know, my partners are largely based in Los Angeles. Mark and I were here in San Francisco. So I never moved down to Los Angeles, but, you know, we would go there frequently. Now, as part of that, I had been helping out Gavin Newsom, who's the current governor of San Francisco, of California. And he was at the time running for mayor of San Francisco. So this was in 2003. And I was the co-chair of his finance committee. So, you know, would help organize fundraisers for him. You know, obviously he won the mayorship in San Francisco in 2004. And then he's like, Michael, you're a finance guy. I need someone on the San Francisco Employee Retirement Board. And that at the time was a $12 billion pension fund. to benefit the retired employees of the city of San Francisco. So that was another sort of transformative step, because that was the first time I was on the LP side of the table. I think we did a pretty good job. Today, that pension fund is about $40 billion, like $38 billion. So that was nice growth. And San Francisco was one of the first public pension funds really to go deep into private markets, so public equity and private equity and venture.
It's interesting because at this point, the sense I get is you've got this really successful career in the finance space, in the corporate space in many ways. But then the next move you made was really interesting, where you said, you know what, I'm going to give this up and I'm going to be a founder, and you're going to start your own fund, and you're going to go to these LPs and try and raise capital. And maybe before we get into Sendana, can you talk about, I love using the word magic moment, and I don't know if it was a magic moment or a just sliding doors moment. What was that? Where were you at in your career at that point? Because it sounds like you were quite senior. Would that be a fair estimate?
You know, I was probably in my mid-30s back then. And so I wouldn't call myself senior, but I was a partner at a venture capital firm, had, you know, could make investments, et cetera. And I think it wasn't so much a magic moment, but kind of a series of moments. You know, I really enjoyed working at the very earliest stages. And this is back in the time when, you know, people like Jeff Clavier were known as super angels. They were spending their full time in making investments into seed stage companies. You know, there are times where we were, you know, looking at very, very early stage opportunities like Palantir. You know, Peter Thiel showed me Palantir when they were raising a Series A. You know, Jack Dorsey had his first prototype of the Square reader, you know, the card reader, put it on my iPhone. That was in 2007 or 8. But, you know, so I really liked the technology. I really liked working with early stage companies. I saw, you know, these super angels making investments. And, you know, of course, venture changed through the 2000s. So in the early 2000s, you had firms like Union Square Ventures, True Ventures, Foundry, and they were much smaller funds doing these small initial checks. And then in the mid-2000s, you had people like Josh Koppelman, who started First Round Capital, Steve Anderson, who started Baseline, Mike Maples, who now runs Floodgate. Back then, I think it was called Maples Investments. You know, they were organizing, you know, institutional capital to make what ultimately become known as, you know, seed stage investing. And so that was sort of the transformation within venture. And yet, you know, at Rustic Canyon, we were doing all kinds of different stages of investing. I really liked early stage. And so ultimately I decided, and this is partly informed because I'd spent time on the, you know, the public pension fund board, that I want to be on the LP side of the table. I see this opportunity where I will, because, you know, obviously no one grows up thinking I'm going to run a fund of funds, but that's actually sort of a confluence of events that got me to the point where I said, there's an opportunity here to start investing in these nascent little funds, you know, the seed funds, and I'm going to raise a pool of capital around it. So ultimately, you know, I left Rustic Canyon at the end of 2009, and at the beginning of 2010, you know, February 23rd, we signed the papers to form Sendana Capital. It's easier said than done. Then it became a total pain in the ass to go raise the first fund, right? So, you know, I had a pretty good network of potential investors, but, you know, I would say that you got to also remember this is coming out of 2008, right? The global financial crisis. And, you know, there was a huge emphasis on liquidity. You know, I was a first-time fund manager. I was a solo GP, and I was also a fund of funds, meaning that, you know, I raised capital and then I invested into these portfolio funds. But in terms of fees, you know, it's a stacking of fees, you know, because you have to pay the fees of the underlying portfolio fund, and then we have our own fees. And so, you know, I would pitch, you know, probably out of, you know, I'd say 99.99% of the people I pitched said no, you know, for a variety of reasons. Some of them I just mentioned. Others thought that they could do it themselves. Others didn't think it was a real thing. Like, isn't this just a fad? So I did take that leap, and I'd have to say my wife Letitia was extremely supportive. And she, you know, when you get told no 99.99 times out of a 100, you know, it's easy to start getting discouraged. But I actually never felt truly discouraged. And you know, my wife Letitia was super supportive. And you know, she's like, Mikey, if it doesn't work out, you can always go back in investment banking. So you know, I was very fortunate that she was so supportive.
This episode is brought to you by Full Stack Advisory. Tired of accountants who just don't understand your tech business? Full Stack Advisory is Australia's top tech accounting firm designed specifically for innovative tech founders and investors. They provide founder-friendly support across accounting and tax, R&D tax incentives, bookkeeping, and CFO advisory, so you can focus on what you do best, innovating and growing your business. Head across to fullstack.com.au and tell them Vidit from the High Flyers podcast sent you to have your accounting needs sorted by Stuart and the team. That's fullstack.com.au.
I'm glad you mentioned her name, because I want to ask two questions, and maybe we'll start with the first is... You also had a young child at this point. Yeah, I think you had a 3-year-old, right? And you had you talked about it in another interview where you said you had $1 million in personal runway. Is that right? So had you taken that money? Was that your money for your career? Yeah, let me explain that.
So, you know, I had my own personal savings, but as part of starting Sendana, and I think this is a part of a playbook that new fund managers can also use, I raised $1 million of working capital. And so effectively, it was like a $1 million round on a $9 million pre. So basically, the people who gave, and there were six of my friends who gave me that $1 million, they basically got 10% of the economics of Sendana. So right. Because I had that cushion, at least I felt like I had enough runway, you know, including my own savings, to go out and launch Sendana.
Right, great. That is very helpful liquidity for sure. And the other part, you talked about the noise, and I believe it took you 18 months to raise the first fund, if my research is correct. And you sort of alluded to it before. How did you get past the noise? How did you turn the noise into yeses? Did you have any tactical learnings you can share?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, obviously pointing out to the different funds that had done well. You know, so I mentioned Mike Maples, Steve Anderson, Josh Koppelman. And I think by then people, more sophisticated LPs understood that the traditional path for venture financing had changed a little bit, because historically, you know, the big multi-stage firms would come in and write the first check. And as those firms got bigger, you know, they had to write, they couldn't write a $1 million check. And then, you know, most importantly, I'd say, is that the cost of starting a company became an order of magnitude cheaper. So in 1999, you would, if you wanted to start a software company, you needed $5 million. You actually had to buy Sun Microsystems servers. You had to buy software licenses. And that's why back then, the first round used to look like $5 million raised for venture capital for 50% of a company. So you'd have two VC firms coming in for 2.5 each and owning 25%. But then you started having the firms I mentioned, like Union Square or True or Foundry, first round. They started doing smaller rounds because Amazon Web Services, because of open source software. Literally now you can start a software company for $500,000, right? So that's an order of magnitude less of capital you need upfront for a founder to start a company. But yet the multi-stage firms are getting bigger and bigger. So if you're a founder and you only need $1 million, $2 million to start, there's a real opportunity cost for those multi-stage funds partners to give you $1 million, to invest $1 million. They need to write 10, 20, $30 million checks. So that's actually sort of the opening that created the opportunity for these seed funds to start. And so that was actually the dynamic that was in our first pitch that I would explain to investors. And then I would show them some of the results, you know, and talk about how, you know, these seed funds were owning 10% of a company. And, you know, if that company sold for $200 million, they would return half the fund, you know, because these were back then, you know, $40 million funds. And so I think people started understanding that. And, you know, I was fortunate to have that, to be early in identifying this, and then also having some tailwind at my back around it.
And can you talk about the economics of a fund of funds? Like, generally we know VC is a 2-in-20 model. Is that the same with a fund of funds structure?
I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, there's an annual management fee, and then there's a some carried interest. And so, whereas I'd say that venture capital funds generally charge 2.5% annual management fee and get 20-25% of carry. The top firms actually get 30% of carry. The fund of funds, we charge 1 in 10. So we charge a 1% annual management fee, and we get 10% of the carry. And so just to quickly explain carry, you know, if you have a $100 million fund and you double that, so you've made $100 million of gain, you know, 20% of that gain, or $20 million, is your carried interest. So that's actually what the partners get. So it's basically profit sharing. But as I mentioned earlier, there's fee stacking, meaning an investor in my fund is not only paying us, but they have to pay the underlying fund managers economics as well.
And you're also investing directly in founders, right? So you're also a VC fund, a traditional VC fund that you're going direct into rounds on cap tables.
Yeah, a small part of what we do, we have a separate fund to do that, where we're investing in actually portfolio companies of our fund managers, largely Series B. But that's a much smaller sort of activity that we do. Today, we have about $2 billion of assets under management. And I would say that less than 10% of that is around direct investing.
Right. We hear the word track record a lot for a new GP or even a new founder, traditional startup. What about LP on the LP side? Like, do you have to build track record where when you go to, like, early on in 2010s, when you went to GPs and you said, I'm Sedona Capital, I want to be an LP in your fund. How do you build that track record in the early days as an LP?
You know, I think those were sort of the I wouldn't say wild, but they were kind of frontier days. And so a lot of the fund managers that we invested in, they were raising their first fund as well. So, you know, what I did was, and I think this was pretty unique at the time, because historically institutional LPs were a lot more passive with their investments into venture capital funds. You know, they would get the allocation to a fund manager and then go maybe once a year to the annual meeting. Because I was coming more from a VC background, from an investing background, you know, I wanted to be a lot more hands-on. And so, you know, I'll just give you a quick example. So Kirsten Green runs a fund called Forerunner. And, you know, today she has a $500 million fund plus a $500 million opportunity fund. Back in the day, she was raising her first fund, which was $40 million. And so we really liked Kirsten. And, you know, we can talk about how we diligenced her, but ultimately we committed $10 million to her. And then we actually introduced her to Duke University's endowment. So they came in, we introduced her to another fund of funds. They came in and we introduced some others. And so it was sort of like a VC shaping the round. I would say that I was pretty proactive and in helping shape the initial capital base for her fund. And so that's the kind of hands-on activity that we were doing. And I think that was very different from most traditional institutional LPs.
And I think the other part, Michael, that you've spoken a lot about it, and it's clear with Sindana, is you've backed a lot of first-time fund managers, and that seems to be a very clear strategy, and a lot of solo GPs as well. And a cynic might look at that and go, why wouldn't you back established funds? So how did you get conviction in backing early funds and backing solo GPs? Because a lot of LPs stay away from that, where they see that as not their space.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think the traditional institutional LPs, they want to see stability. And the danger of investing in a first fund is, you know, oftentimes it's one or two partners. And then one of the biggest risks in venture is that the partnership blows up. The ultimately, you know, because it's a 12-year sort of fund. And, you know, can two people actually stay partners together for that time period? And, you know, that's longer than the average marriage in the U.S. You know, I think seeing the dynamic of how partners would work together on a first-time fund, institutional LPs probably want to see a few fund cycles where it's clear that they're working well before making a commitment. And you know, when you're a new fund, and this goes to part of one of the things that we look for, you really have to have a discernible edge. Like if you're a founder, you have a very interesting company and you have multiple offers from different firms, you know, why are you going to pick that one over this one? And you know, that seed stage investing is very competitive in the US. And you know, I think we always look for fund managers who had that sort of discernible edge. And I, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, domain expertise, and the networks that they bring to the table. And, you know, one thing about the seed stage funds, a lot of the GPs, you know, a lot of the partners have operating experience. They've had their own startups. So actually, if you look at like late stage investors, you know, not picking on them in particular, but like say Insight Partners, or any of these other later stage firms, a lot of them are actually ex-bankers and consultants and lawyers. But when you look at the seed stage funds, a lot of them are actually ex-entrepreneurs. And that actually is the discernible edge, because, or part of it, because, you know, founders want people who have been in the trenches before to help them, you know, work. So you know, our fund managers roll up their sleeves. They're working very closely with the founders. They're helping them with product roadmap, thinking through what metrics they need to hit. They're helping through with hiring. They're thinking through, you know, business model. And so, you know, it's a lot of work. And I'm not saying other VCs don't do other work, but I'm just saying in particular, seed stage investors do a lot of work with the founders. And so founders want, you know, someone who has that experience.
You mentioned earlier about diligence process. Maybe we'll go into this and we can cross it with your three focus areas. And I think your focus areas might have slightly evolved, but I think they're roughly the same, where you invest in seed managers at 100 million or less, pre-seed at 50 or less, and then international markets with Australia, yeah, Israel, China, India being some of the ones that you've got on your website currently.
Right.
Maybe we'll talk about the fund size first before we go into geography. Are there any differences in your diligence process between a seed manager and a pre-seed manager?
I would say no. Not a diligence process, but let me explain. So for us, seed stage funds, you know, generally speaking, seed stage companies are raising $3 to $4 million. They have initial product market fit. They have a lot of the management team already hired. And so, you know, it contrasts that with a pre-seed stage company, which oftentimes is a founder with a PowerPoint. So that is truly idea stage. And certainly pre-product market fit, because there's probably no product. And so what we've seen over the last 12 years is that the pre-seed funds tend to be smaller. Around 50 million is sort of the median in our portfolio. And, you know, they're getting 15% ownership with their $1 million check, $1.5 million check. The seed funds today tend to be closer to 125, 150, actually. And, you know, they're writing $2 to $3 million checks, and they're getting somewhere between 10 to 15% ownership. And what's interesting, at least from our perspective, is that when we did the analysis of like mortality rates, you know, meaning what percentage of pre-seed companies that our fund managers have funded, you know, go to zero versus our seed managers, which presumably are a little bit later stage, go to zero, it was actually identical. The mortality rate for our portfolio funds that are pre-seed versus seed, the mortality rates were the same. And so as part of our new fund, we're actually committing more capital to the pre-seed fund managers. Now, but your question was more around diligence. And I would say that the core of our diligence is really to talk to as many founders as possible, as well as co-investors. So in the example of Kirsten and Forerunner, you know, she was a first-time fund manager, but not a first-time investor. She had raised a small pool of capital from a friend. She had been investing in it, but she was investing in companies like Warby Parker. So as part of our diligence, we would call the founders of Warby Parker and say, what do you think of Kirsten? And they're like, she's the person we call at 11 p.m. when we're worried about something. She has the most domain expertise of all of our investors. And then our question was, well, if she had a $40 million fund, you know, could you have envisioned her leading the seed round? And, you know, they said absolutely, as did, you know, the other 38 we called. So that's how we sort of diligenced it and got comfortable that, you know, Kirsten was special and that someone, even though it was a first time fund, that some is someone that we really wanted to back. And, you know, I mentioned that we put 10 million into that first fund of 40. You know, that's also reflective of our approach. We want to be high conviction investors. We actually tell our LPs that we want to be the lead investor in a fund that we invest in.
You've mentioned Kirsten a few times, that she must clearly impress you and they must be doing well as a fund. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, she's done well, but I mean, but pretty much most of our portfolio managers, I can recount the same stories.
Mm. And the other side, Michael, I touched on earlier, is your geographical expansion, where you've invested in international funds. When did that first start? What was your first international fund, and how did you get conviction in having an international portfolio of GPs?
Yeah, I mean, we had been meeting with non-US fund managers from day one. We probably met with more non-US fund managers than US fund managers. And so, you know, you mentioned Nikki and Sam from Blackbird. I met with Nikki before he started Blackbird, him and Rick Baker. And they were pitching me Fund One, and we were talking about what that would look like, et cetera. And that was well over 10 years ago. The one thing that was holding us back about non-US investing was we didn't feel like the ecosystems were quite mature yet. And what I mean by that is, it is easier to start a seed fund, but unless there's a lot of local follow-on capital, it can be a very difficult ecosystem. So you can imagine, just to pick on a place like Atlanta in the U.S. You know, there are seed funds there, but there are not really many local Series A or B funds there. So basically, for those companies to raise their next round, they have to rely on people flying in from San Francisco or New York or Boston or LA. Now, obviously, with the pandemic and with the advent of Zoom, you know, it's been a little bit easier. But historically, we very much focused on the availability of local follow-on capital. And so, you know, a place like London, we knew most of the seed funds and had been talking to them for years. But London is a good example because, you know, they had firms like Balderton or Index, or, you know, Accel London, but basically a handful of Series A firms. And if those firms passed on a company that a seed fund in London had funded, that company was pretty much dead in the water because there weren't other sources of capital. I mean, today it's a vibrant ecosystem. There's a lot more Series A funds. Continental firms have gotten bigger, and a lot of the US firms have opened offices, you know, for example, like Sequoia, in London. So London is a very good ecosystem at the seed stage. But, you know, that's really developed over the past 5 to 7 years. So that's why we waited on investing in outside the US, you know, until just 5 years ago.
One of the things that I do a lot going into any episode is a lot of research. And I reached out to our mutual friend, Shiel Benot, and I said, what questions should I ask Michael? And he gave me a list of questions. And the biggest thing he said is, ask Michael about how his thought process has changed. And I understand, as any fund, you've evolved with the times and things are a bit different today. And one of the things Shiel mentioned is that Sindana used to only invest in funds that led deals, whereas now you don't, and now you're a lot more flexible. Can you talk about that thought process change?
Yeah, that's actually a very perceptive question by Shiel. And so what I would say is our thought process has evolved. And back in the day, we would say we're investing in fund managers who lead their investments. What that really meant was that they're getting high ownership in a company for their initial check. And we've actually evolved that to saying, you know, we invest in fund managers who are getting relatively high ownership or high ownership relative to their fund size. So what that means is, you know, if you're a $25 million fund, you're not going to be leading that many deals because you're not going to be able to write $2 to $3 million into a round and lead it. But you might be getting, you know, 10% ownership, and for a $25 million fund to get 10% ownership, that's pretty good. And so the way and this was based on our data and the analysis we did, in general, our seed fund managers are getting about 10% of fund size as their initial ownership. So if you're $100 million seed fund, you're getting about 10% initial ownership. And that's based on our data, our portfolio funds. The pre-seed fund managers are actually getting 20% of their fund size as initial ownership. So if you are an $80 million pre-seed fund, you're getting basically 16% ownership. And that's that. So that was my earlier comment, is that the pre-seed managers are actually getting higher ownership relative to fund size. But we're not necessarily looking for fund managers that are leading their deals. We don't characterize that that way anymore. It's more like, are they punching above their weight relative to their fund size? Because we do have, you know, 25, we have 30, $35 million funds. And again, they're not going to be leading their deals, but they are getting substantial ownership relative to the size of their fund. So that most definitely is an evolution of our thinking.
Right. The other one that Sheil suggested was that even the size cap on funds has evolved, where you've sort of changed your thinking on that. Can you unpack that?
This is so, you know, we spend a lot of time with our fund managers working through their portfolio construction, what their next fund size should be. You know, I'd say that when I started Cendana, the seed funds were about 40, 50 million in size. Seed rounds were about 2 million. And, you know, these fund managers were writing $1 million check into a $2 million round. But as I mentioned, you know, today seed rounds are more like 4 million. And so our fund managers are writing $2 to $3 million into those rounds. So imagine a portfolio of, say, 30 companies. You're writing $3 million checks. So that's $90 million of initial investment. And then you have to have reserves, you know, for the follow-on investment in the next round. And typically it's one-to-one. So, you know, $90 million of initial invested capital, $90 million in reserves. Suddenly you're looking at $180 million seed fund. And, you know, I think our fund managers have gotten bigger. Our seed fund managers have gotten bigger, not because they want more management fee, but it's just because for them to lead their rounds, to get the ownership they want, that they're targeting, they're having to write bigger checks. And so, you know, this has been sort of an evolution over the past 5 years. I think, you know, 2021 is a sort of an outlier year in terms of pace of investing and valuations. And, you know, I think that hopefully some of our fund managers and the rest of the seed fund market recognizes that size determines strategy, and that becoming too large is actually going to impact your returns. I feel like we're actually, over the next few years, are going to see maybe a return to normalcy, where the seed funds are trending back toward 100 million as sort of the ideal size. The good thing about the pre-seed fund managers, they never decided to get larger. When we look at our, you know, first cohort of pre-seed funds back in 2012, you know, the median size was 40. When we look at the cohort of pre-seed funds that we have today, the median size is 50. So they didn't double, triple in size. So they've kept themselves relatively consistent.
Can I ask, on the pre-seed, there's something that I think about, and there's a bunch of fund managers currently in Australia fundraising, and they're first-time fund managers, and they're aiming for $5 to $10 million as their pre-seed fund size, because they want to be very calculated. And to your point, they want to build ownership, but they want to make less checks per year, and they want to get higher returns. And I think the data shows that a smaller fund tends to return 4, 5, 6 times their LP's money, versus a big fund takes obviously longer because the economics are different. What are your thoughts on that? This is a more general question. Do you think that's a right fund size to be $5 to $15 million at pre-seed?
Well, what I would say is that the funds like that, perhaps for them, as part of the journey, is more of like a demo fund. They're raising a pool of capital from friends, family, and anyone else they can get networked to. They are, you know, they become a viable fund, assuming they, you know, that they, the management fee is sufficient to keep them, you know, housed and clothed and fed. But, you know, that's where they can start making investments. And then they have a portfolio of companies. And then if, as long as they stick to what they said that they were going to do, you know, early stage investing in software, for example, and not like late doing an opportunistic Series C at $1 billion valuation, you know, I think that gives them more credibility to raise their next fund, which could be 25, 50, you know, 75 million in size. So that's the progression that we see. It's harder for someone to come out of the box, straight out of the box, and raise like a $50 million fund, first fund. There are people who can do that, of course, who are more than likely, you know, junior partners at the more established VC funds. They can come out and say, hey, I'm hanging out my own shingle, I'm going to raise $100 million first fund. And, you know, oftentimes they're able to do that. But if you're more of an operator or an entrepreneur or have your own startup, but you have your own unique network, raising $5 to $15 million initially, I think that's a really good way to start. And I think that is more of a demo fund on that approach as opposed to like pre-seed or seed. Because, you know, with a $15 million fund, you could still be investing in seed stage companies as opposed to pre-seed companies.
Yeah, yeah. We talked earlier about Blackbird, and they've done some amazing things in a country in Australia where 10 years ago VC was non-existent. And you mentioned about Nikki and Sam Wong and him being strong backers. And I reached out to both of them. And I guess their question was, what have you learned about the Australian and New Zealand ecosystem that surprised you the most?
That's a really good question. You know, so when I met with Rick and Nikki over 10 years ago, they were talking about Australia, you know, the sense of entrepreneurship. And, you know, Australia being a small population, similar to Israel, you know, the founders always have to be global from day one. And I think we've seen a lot of successes around that, you know, Canva being a good example, Atlassian being another good example, and a whole host of other companies. And so, you know, I feel like the Aussie and Kiwi entrepreneurs are kind of pretty much like what you would see here running around in Stanford or, you know, New York or Boston or LA. You know, I think the other thing that's really happened over the past 10 years is that the playbook for founders is a lot more transparent. There are a lot more VCs writing about what they want to see, a lot of founders talking about their journeys. And so, you know, I think that sort of sense of entrepreneurship and the playbook of starting a company, that's better understood. And, you know, I think, but you're asking me specifically anything that surprised me. I wouldn't say that I'm surprised. I would just say that it was more a reinforcement of what I believe, which was that, you know, Aussies and Kiwis have a really strong sense of entrepreneurship.
I would love to bring it back, Michael, to LPs, and then we'll close with some rapid fire sprint questions. Is one of the things we talk a lot about in the VC world is that it's a team sport, but individual game where you've got individual relationships with founders, you're on boards, and you're learning as an individual. What's it like on the LP side? Like, what's your learning journey like? Do you sit with other LPs and have offsites, or do you listen to their podcasts? How do you grow your own journey as an LP?
Yeah. So part of the value prop that I think we've given to our Sendana LPs is that we're very collaborative. And so, you know, a number of them actually set aside pools of capital to invest directly into the portfolio funds that we have. So in a way, they view us as a platform investment. You know, they invested in Sendana, but they have their own pool of capital. And together, we work so that they can make investments directly into our portfolio funds. And that sounds all reasonable and logical, but it's very different than historically how venture capital fund-to-funds operated. They were very guarded about their relationships, and they would not introduce their LPs to the underlying portfolio funds because, you know, their entire raison d'etre was that they had the access, and they weren't about to just give that access to all their LPs. So what I would say is that from the beginning, we've been very collaborative with other LPs. I mentioned the story about 4Runner, how we introduced Kirsten to a number of our LPs, and we do that with all of our portfolio funds. You know, Shield at Better Tomorrow, we were the first institutional LP to commit to them. We introduced them to a bunch of our LPs, et cetera. And, but, you know, in general, to answer your question, yeah, we talk to LPs all the time, other LPs, even non-Sendana LPs. So, you know, we're friends with a lot of different university endowments, family offices. We're friends with Cambridge Associates, for example, which is a big consulting firm that does a lot of private market investing. And we're always comparing notes. You know, I think it's important for people in the LP world to see, to understand what's going on. And, you know, where it's very, very different for compared to a VC firm. So a VC fund, you know, there's a finite and generally speaking, a much smaller amount of capital available for a company. If a hot company is raising like a $10 million round, it is sharp elbowed. Like all the VC firms aren't going to collaborate. They're going to try to get as much of that as possible. Fact is, with venture capital funds, they're much larger, you know, let's say $100 million. So we're not ever going to take all $100 million of it. Hmm. We'll take what we ask for, which is generally $10 to $15, $20 million. But there's obviously room for others. And we want that fund manager to succeed. So we are actually very collaborative. we actually introduce our fund managers to other LPs. And, you know, we compare notes all the time. So it is much more collaborative today than I would say, say 10 years ago.
And let's assume you're in a room of Hall of Fame LPs, your peer LPs, and there's five seats and you've got one seat. Who would be the other four LPs you'd like to be in that room with?
I'd say my two seats could be for my partners, Graham Pingree and Kelly. but assuming other non-Sindana LP types, you know, I think Brian Rona, who runs the private markets team at Notre Dame, is remarkable. They have probably the best portfolio of seed stage funds for a university endowment. And again, Brian is someone who's a good friend. He's on our reference list. He is not an LP at Sindana, but we think he's a superstar. You know, I'd say Ben Liu, who runs the private markets team at the J. Paul Getty Trust. So the Getty Museum in LA has a very large endowment. And Ben's been there, I'd say, probably now 15, 20 years. And he's built out an amazing portfolio. He's a super thoughtful LP. He spends a lot of time really getting to know the the GPs, and has, you know, I think, tremendous access to all the best funds. So definitely Ben. You know, I'd also add Mike Larson, who is a managing director at Cambridge Associates. He's not, as a consulting firm, they don't have a pool of capital that they're actually allocating. They might have some discretionary accounts, but in general, they're advising a lot of endowments and foundations and family offices. And I think, you know, Mike is someone I've known for over 15 years. I think he has a deep appreciation and understanding of venture. You know, I think he's also, and all these guys are super, super nice people. I would add Erwin Gross. So Erwin was one of the co-founders of Sequoia Heritage. And so that's the endowment model that Sequoia set up, largely that their partners initially put spare change into. They actually raised capital out from outside. And I would say that they are phenomenal investors. They see everything. And this is not Sequoia Capital, the venture firm. It's the endowment that they created. And, you know, Erwin was always on a plane flying into the jungles of Borneo, you know, going down rivers in Brazil. Like he is a true investor. He would look anywhere and to find that extra alpha, the extra return. So he's also a phenomenal sort of strategic thinker. And, you know, he's retired now, but we're fortunate that he's actually on our advisory board. So we talk to Erwin every so often. And as for a fourth or the fifth, let's just say, we'll keep that one open and let others compete for that.
I like it. Thank you for that answer. I didn't give you this question prior, so it was on the spot. So yeah, That's a great answer. And last question, Michael, before we go to a quick rapid fire sprint to close us out. I think one of the questions that a lot of the GPs asked that they want to ask you is, and you're probably getting this question daily, is where do you see the next 3 years in venture? Do you think there'll be a contraction? Like one of the jokes always is that venture funds die slow. Yeah. Do you think there's a bit of that where things will change?
So, you know, we have, I think now 65 fund managers. We actually do a monthly call with each one. So for 30 minutes, and these are all individual calls. So we have a lot of monthly calls and, you know, we get a really good sense of how the market is shaping up. You know, they're talking about new investments and, you know, clearly over the last 12 months, things have slowed down materially compared to 2021, but it's actually at the same pace it was 2018, 2019, 2020. So that earlier I said 2021 is an outlier. If you just got rid of 2021 statistics, you know, you'd actually see a relatively smooth progression from 18, 19, and 20. But, you know, so the pace of investing is slower than compared to 2021. The bar to raise a Series A is much, much higher. And so, you know, what you've seen, I guess, in the past 6 or 9 months, when people talk about triaging their portfolio, you know, they identify the top third of their portfolio companies, making sure they have enough runway. Let's say historically you needed 1 million of ARR to raise a Series A. Let's say today it's more like 2.5 million. And so, you know, you can't just magically create that extra incremental ARR. You actually need more time. And so our fund managers have spent time adding capital to their top companies, ensuring that they have the runway so they have the metrics when they go out and raise the Series A. And, you know, we hear from our monthly calls that for the most part, the companies that have gone out for Series A's in the last 12 months have been able to raise it. Now, of course, nothing is ever perfect. And we do hear of cases where they went out for an A and they couldn't raise it. And so then you have this, you have this decision to make. Do you continue to support the company? Maybe they just need more capital, more runway, so they can go out and raise the A 6 months or a year from now. And so that's sort of the consternation, sort of the hand-wringing, the anguish that you're going to, that's going on right now, is deciding whether to support existing companies. I do think that there was also this dynamic where people were holding off on going out to raise their Series A's and B's. And you're actually going to see more of a flood of those coming in the second half of this year and the beginning of next year. So I think you're going to actually see, you're going to see more carnage. You're going to see companies get shut down. And you're certainly going to see, for later stage companies, more down rounds. But at the end of the day, if you can raise more capital and extend the life of a viable company, a promising company, then that's worth it. It's totally not worth it to keep a zombie company alive. So that's also the difficult decision, decisions that a VC has to make is, do we keep this company alive? Can they live to fight another day? Or should we just call it quits? And the worst thing you can do, and this is the lesson from, the first internet bubble that you and I talked about a while ago, a lot of VC funds were bridging companies, putting more capital, basically throwing good money after bad. And they might have had a good portfolio or a promising portfolio, but when you start dumping half the remaining fund into these companies that were never going to make it, you basically destroyed your portfolio. So follow-on capital decisions are super, super important. And bridges can become peers. And that's what we've been telling our fund managers that, you may want to, if you're thinking about bridging a company, you got to know exactly what you're bridging to, right? Because bridges can be peers and you can end up just falling into the ocean.
Great. Absolutely. We've got a few minutes left, Michael. So left to close with a quick rapid fire final sprint. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life, non-financial?
Yeah. I mean, the education that we're giving our children. I think that's priceless, and we really spend a lot of time and effort on that. So that's that, without a doubt.
One thing you'd like to learn in the next 6 months?
I'd love to do a deeper dive into generative AI and how all the models work and what the opportunities are there. Because the general public sees ChatGPT and intuitively gets it. They can figure out the utility for it, which you really couldn't do on blockchain. So if you actually took the average person off the street and said, hey, give me 3 use cases for blockchain, most people wouldn't be able to give you one. Mm-hmm. But if you that same person off the street, they could probably give you 10 different use cases for generative AI. So mm-hmm. I just want to do a much deeper dive. It's clearly generational technology.
Mm. I've been told your Twitter handle, MKRocks, is your gamer tag, and you used to play games back in the day. So what's one thing you've learned from video games?
I don't know if I've learned much. At one point, I was in the top 2% in the world on Call of Duty on console, on Xbox. I still play probably 30 minutes to an hour a day at night just to relax. And, I do think, Call of Duty specifically is a first-person shooter, right? And so, it does teach you interesting tactics. Like, don't just rush headlong into something. It's sometimes better to stay back and observe first. And so I think maybe that's a tangible lesson for real world.
Most recent fund you announced that you invested in?
Let's see. Well, I don't know. Well, actually today, there was one announced today. It's called MXV, and M times V is momentum. Mass times velocity equals momentum. So this was started by a person named Mark Germazian. He's based in New York. He was the co-founder and CEO of a company called Braze, which is a public company, $3 billion kind of market cap. And so Mark came more from an operating, from a founder kind of role. and he raised a $52 million fund. And you know, we're very proud to be part of him, his fund. And, you know, he's focused on enterprise and SaaS and marketing SaaS. So, you know, we think he brings, and it gets back to what I was talking about. He is an entrepreneur who other entrepreneurs and founders want to work with because he has that experience. In fact, he has the experience of taking a company public.
Mm. And last one, Michael, is there one person, a quote that inspires you today?
Yes. So let me get the quote right. The greatest wealth is health. And that is a quote from Virgil, who was a Roman poet. You know, he wrote Aeneid. And I actually think that as I get older, I think of myself as still pretty young, but as you get older, you know, you realize you start seeing the older generation dying off and, you know, people having health issues. And I think you could be very wealthy monetarily or even socially or, you know, family wise, but if you don't have your health, it's game over. So I think the greatest wealth is health.
Mm, great note to end on. That's the finish line. Michael Kim, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
Well, there you have it. Michael Kim from Sindana Capital. Michael is highly regarded in the venture capital community globally, so this was a real thrill. I hope you enjoyed learning more about Michael's story and Sindana Capital, especially getting the real peek behind the curtains of how the investors behind the VCs invest and operate. And Michael is very kind in answering all my probing questions with depth and context. His points around pre-seed versus seed fund returns and how he turned no's into yeses in raising his first fund with Sindana were particularly interesting to me. See you next week for episode 132 and get your tickets to the live fireside chat with James Tynan, partner at Square Peg, link in the show notes. Talk soon.